The Tea Stop In podcast is inspired by a long tradition of relaxed conversations about the film industry and the craft of cinematography. As a working cinematographer, producer, and colorist, Ben Allen, ACSCSI, gets to have conversations with some of the most exciting people in the industry today. And we're inviting you to listen in. The Tea Stop In.
I'm Ben Allen, and welcome to Season 3 of The Tea Stop In. And the first episode brought to you with the sponsorship support of our friends at ARRI Australia and MZ.com. Our first guest this season is one of the absolute giants of the cinematography world. Two-time ACS Cinematographer of the Year, winner of two ASC Awards and a six-time nominee, BAFTA winner and six-time nominee, Cameron Marge Lifetime Achievement Award winner, five-time Oscar nominee, and Academy Award winner. John Seal, ACS, ASC, AM. Welcome to the Tea Stop In.
Good morning.
Now, John, in the first two seasons of this podcast, your name has probably come up more than any other, both as a mentor and a role model, but also with people like Peter James as a camera operator. And you really focused on camera operating for quite a while, didn't you?
In the earlier days of my career, I did love operating. I thought camera operating was about the best job you could ever get, because you, before monitors, you were the link between the director, the actors, and the final result on the screen. So that by looking through the camera endlessly at actors, listening to what the director wanted, trying to work out what an editor would need as well to suitably cut that scene to make it work, they were kind of the early thoughts. They later became far more elaborate as to exactly what size would intercut with the next cut. Could you anticipate the editor? Should you anticipate the editor? Things like that. So I found that the work as a camera operator, day in and day out on episodic TV, the occasional film back then, but mainly episodic TV, was a great experience in trying to do exactly that, try and work out exactly what the camera should be doing, should be recording for everybody's benefit.
And so what sort of shows are we talking about there?
I did a lot of stuff for Fauna Productions, the Barrier Reef series, Shannon's Mob, things like that. A lot even before then of the, for the ABC, when they, in the very, very early stages of their beginnings, they decided to go into episodic TV and decided through their older generation coming aboard at that time that it should be 35mm negative, which was then the only camera that they could find was a blimped Mitchell R35.
Wow.
Which was about half the size of a Volkswagen and took a great big geared head underneath it.
Yeah, yeah.
So learning a geared head very quickly and early was essential. I had one of the saddest transitions in my film life, actually, was that I was focus pulling, and then prior to that I was clapper loading and things like that. But when I was focus pulling at the ABC, as they started into episodic and also feature-length films that would go on as a sort of a monthly deal,
yeah,
they were shooting those as well.
Wow.
But our camera operator, very, very sadly, was killed in the helicopter crash over the Goldfields building at the Quay. And we were just, I believe that occurred on the weekend, on the Saturday that that helicopter crashed, and we were due to start a drama on the Monday.
Wow.
So suddenly they didn't have a camera operator. And unfortunately, in the world's atmospheres, you go ahead. You do go ahead. And so Bill Grimmond, who's since passed away sadly as well, he was the director of photography, and he said, well, John should do it. And they said, but he's not a cameraman. And Bill said, but he can do the geared head, because I used to practice every time somebody wasn't on the geared head, I was on it. And he said, he can do the geared head. that said to them, okay, we'll give him a go. So that's how I actually started operating under very sad circumstances. And out of that, I went for years, and all of my colleagues all blasted through into lighting. But I held back because I did love operating so much. And it still is, to me, one of the most interesting jobs you can have on the set. As long as I feel you can dig into what you're doing and why and how it will help, how it might not help. Should it, you know, there's
so it's more than just a mechanical process.
It's a million questions as to what are you presenting to the audience through an editor, through your cameraman, through your lighting cameraman. And I used to have, I won't say arguments with them, but I had a lot of discussions with them about certain things and attitudes of the camera and what it's doing and why, because that's what I was questioning all the time. So I found that when I was operating for very sharp and good young DPs of the time, you know, Russell Boyd, Peter James, Don McAlpine, and operating for them, that I would question still what the camera was doing, not what the lighting necessarily was doing, of course, but I always felt that part of the composition was using the key light. Where was it coming from? What was it? And should it be in shot? And if there wasn't something there that gave that highlight, I would say to Cameron, can we put something there, a practical light or something to key off that, so that I could get that in frame as part of a compositional factor or a dramatic factor? Thousands of questions you can ask about simply what is a practical light. And they would say, oh, yes, okay, that's not a bad idea. Or others might say, no, I can't put one in there because I've got this and that. Oh, okay. So we move on. But I was always questioning those sort of things, and it was all got back to what was the camera doing. And then when I started lighting as well, because I, you know, somebody, the lovely Maurice Murphy, offered me a movie, and I thought, oh, yep, I'll go along. And I was asked to operate on it. And I said, well, who's the cameraman? The lighting cameraman. And they went, we were hoping, said Maurice, that for an extra cup of tea a day, you light it as well. And I thought, what? I'm going to light and operate? And I thought, maybe it's time, you know. Yeah. So that's when I sort of started.
And what was that experience like, diving into lighting?
A bit deadly, because your workload increases remarkedly.
Yeah.
You know, the director of photography has a lot of other questions he has to answer, as well as an operator who wants a lot of question answers, so that the workload was quite fierce.
Yeah.
That little one was good. The one that shook me, though, was the one with, you know, with analog meters, and the needle wouldn't keep still.
Yeah.
And I'm lighting and I'm thinking, why doesn't that needle keep still on a number? I need a number out of this little box, you know, and it's not keeping still.
Just move it around till you get the number you want.
God, don't tell anybody that. So that threw me a lot, and I was very, very nervous about that. But we got through. I had a wonderful gaffer, Mick Morris, who's now up in Cape Upstart in Queensland, and he held my hand. Quite lovely, and it got me through a lot of the other bigger problems, and taught me a lot of things. You know, about don't try and pick the light. Tell me what you want the light to do, and I'll select the lamp. Simple things like that.
Yeah,
you know?
That's such
a
big. I couldn't
handle that. Yeah. I had to know the lamp, because the characteristics of each lamp were different. Yeah. So I like to then say, I think it should be a little pepper or a little inky or something that we can focus halfway between a flood and a spot. You know, it's just a nice... Anyway, so we had fun with that.
I just want to take a moment now to tell you a bit about one of our sponsors, MZ, because they not only provide a whole lot of professional level online training, but they're also the only place that you can get online training from the ARRI Academy. Now, this is really significant because not only are there in-depth courses from the ARRI Academy, But at the end of those courses, you can get certification from ARRI for having completed those courses. So it's well worth checking out at mz.com. Do you remember the point where you started to really feel comfortable with light meter?
I got confidence fairly quickly over two or three movies. I was asked to shoot, at that stage, the biggest budget film in Australia to light it.
Which was?
I'll remember in a minute. And
would that have been The Survivor?
The Survivor, yeah. With David Hemmings. He was a little bit of a nightmare, a little bit of a wild card, but exciting for that.
Yeah.
But it added to my turmoil, caused a bit of a rumble through the industry that because I had only really done two pictures, low budget, very low budget, that suddenly I was being asked to do this over $1 million picture. And here was this fledgling beginner doing it. And that was fairly nerve-wracking because we ended up with five anamorphic cameras on it at night. Wow. And had one go at blowing this completely full-sized aeroplane in Adelaide, blowing that up. We had one go at it. We had to get it right. So that was all very, very nerve-wracking. But I had confidence then enough to be able to say I'll do it and secondly to be able to do it and using by then a lot of available light off flames from the knowing that that would happen, knowing that I would get a good stop out of that flames, but knowing that I was able to get what we would need on film with slow anamorphic lenses, I was already then confident enough to move into that. But we got through it, and the film didn't do well because it was thrown together a little bit, and David was not really totally in control of it on paper before he started, so it got a bit out of control. But very exciting to do because he was prepared to go to the far ends of visualization and challenge you to do what he wanted. He visualized.
Yeah.
So that was very exciting. So by doing that film is, I think, about the third one that in cinema, was very exciting to do because it really did throw you into the barrel very quickly. And I do love that. I love that students might not hedge away at that either if they're thrown into the barrel, because those challenges stretch you and your maybe limited knowledge, but it stretches you a long way further than you ever thought you might have gone.
Yeah, which and then in future gives you all of that to kind of fall back on and call.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
Very much so. In fact, I found in America when I started shooting there that they couldn't believe how far I'd go. And I'd think, no, this is okay. We haven't reached the fence line yet. And when we get there, well, we might have to cut the wire and keep walking, but we haven't reached the fence line. But they'd say, the great Sidney Pollack was one of them, and he said, can I go again on this dusk shot? And I'd say, yeah, you've got about another four if we keep belting them out, Sidney. We shouldn't muck around here.
Yeah.
The light is going very quickly. So I was putting wires in, changing colours as the sky colour changed.
So you're bringing the lamps down with the ambience.
Yeah. And he turned around about the second last. He said, I don't believe this, that we're still shooting. This is going to come out, is it? And I said, damn well better. Otherwise, I reckon I'll be on the first plane out of here, won't I, Sidney? And he said, he looked at me because people didn't talk to Sidney like that.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful man and I did get on well with him. And partly it was because of that that I was able to kick back and say, well, I hope it does. I'll be on the first plane out. And he couldn't have – no American cameraman talked to him like that. Yeah. It was either, no, we can't do this, or they'd lose their cool and say, well, no, we've got a wrap. And they'd be out of there. All the crew told me that.
What was it like working with him on a visual level?
He was very interesting man. He knew his craft overall. He knew the package that he wanted to present. This was on The Firm with
which is one of my favourite relax movies.
Yeah, exactly.
It's such a beautifully crafted film on every level, I think.
Exactly. And that was Sidney all the way through. I found that he offered up some challenges. There were some very funny moments when Sidney actually started as a cameraman.
Did he really?
Yes.
Wow.
And he still had his viewing filters, you know, his contrast viewing filters. And he'd hang them around his neck every day, and he'd arrive on set. It was sort of like saying, you know, I know what I'm talking about to make the film, but I also know lighting.
So,
you know,
interesting.
And he looked through it. And then after a few days, maybe a week, he said to me, he said, John, he said, this is all looking very dark. And I'd seen his viewing filter, and it did look like quite a dark one. I said, could I have a look through your viewing filter, Sidney, for a second? And he gave it to me, and I looked through it. Well, it was for 16 ASA Eastman colour from 30 years ago. And I said, Sidney, that's
a new one.
That's very old-fashioned, that one, I'm sorry to say. And I went to our camera coordinator guy, and I said, could you please order two sets of new from Kodak colour contrast filters? And within hours they were there, because it was Sidney Sidney Pollack. And within hours they were there, you know. So I gave them to Sidney, and he looked through and he said, oh, that looks a lot better. I said, well, I'd look
so through. So you're on the same page then.
Yeah. I'd look through that one from now on, Sidney, you know, put that one on the behind the door, I think. And then at other times he tried to operate, and it was a very complex 180 degree, very fast across the room. We had to dolly away to let the actors cross there and then dolly back to that position a full 180 degrees later. And Sidney said, well, I'll do this, and if I can't do it, can't be done, we'll do it as an out-of-frame, into-frame cut. And I thought, well, there's a challenge coming up, you know. And so as soon as he got on the dolly, I knew he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Because you'd have to wind yourself up so that when you're operating, you unwind your body.
Yeah.
He sat on it as though he was at the final. So I knew that in trying to do the 180, he was going to fall off the dolly, which he nearly did. Okay, can't be done. We'll do it out of frame, into frame, and do it as a cut. And once again, being a bit cheeky, I think, maybe from Australia, I said, Sidney, I've got my hand up. I said, can I have a go at that? Because I do get paid to do it, and I'd love to have a go at it. And he looked at me, and later one of the crew who'd worked with Sidney for years said, not the sort of thing Sidney's used to hearing, you know. And I said, well, I'm sorry, that's me. But I do get paid to do the job. And if that's the shot he wants, really wants, I'll give it a go.
Internationally, Australians do get away with a little bit more cheekiness.
And
probably
so
a lot
they
of other
should,
people.
Because they're damn good.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, you know, Michael Keaton once on a movie in New York came up to me and he said, John, he said, why are all these Australians so good? Your directors, your actors, your cameraman, yourself, and I'd been asked that so many times over there. I said, Michael, I don't really know, but I've thought about it. And the only thing I can think of is I think it's something they put in the beer. And I said, you know, Australians drink it. Well, he gave me that a typical Michael Keaton throwaway, like, ah. Oh, and walked off, you know, and didn't want to hear anymore, you know. So I've stayed with that because it's the only thing I can think of that's reasonably logical. You know.
So you're doing this to Sidney Pollack. Well, okay, can I have a shot at it?
Yeah, I got very uncomfortable at the start.
Yeah.
You know, set myself up at the end, reasonably comfortable, and then wound myself up to the start.
Yeah.
And said, I'm ready to go. And Sidney disappeared into another room where the monitors were, and we did the take. Tom Cruise, Jeannie Triplehorn, very nicely did it for me. And I got round, the dolly pulled back, let them through, kept going round with them onto the couch. And I got there and I thought, oh, it wasn't bad, but I chipped his head on the way across. And Sidney came out with his eyes as big as saucers, says, you got it in one. And I said, well, I chipped his head on the way around. And Sidney said, oh, I don't think you did. I said, well, let's go and check it. So we went to check it, and sure enough, I just chipped the top of his head. Well, Sydney made me do it 8 times after that and found fault with every one of them until the last one.
Wow.
And that's his way of work. That was his way of working. So you did have to be careful with Sydney with things like that. But by giving it a go, I became good friends with him then. Yeah. It was sort of like I'd call him out. I did
but
it
then
when
you delivered,
he couldn't and delivered.
Yeah.
He came
and I think that's the thing. Like, if you'd called him out and then you hadn't delivered,
then that'd
be a problem.
Yeah, and making me do it 8 times was his I think his way of saying, well, don't muck around with me.
If you're going to go for perfect, you've got to get all the way there.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was quite fun. And once again, it gets back to, I think, those early years of operating where I loved it and I pursued the limits of it. You know, the fact that you had to operate on the balls of your feet like a boxer. Never, ever lean on the camera, the dolly, or stand flat-footed. Have your knees bent, ready to do anything, because that camera might demand that you do anything.
I guess most of that's driven constantly by the actors and what they're doing in the performance.
Sometimes in those early days, our actors were a little bit undisciplined. They'd do a rehearsal at quarter speed, and then all of a sudden they're doing a take, they're wired up and off they go at 3 times the normal rehearsal speed. So you didn't want to get caught flat-footed. So all of that was, I think, the best training that you could ever get was always searching for the parameter of every shot. Could it do this? Yeah. Could we do that? And offering it, because you could do it.
Yeah. In those early days, would you tend to be talking more about the operational aspects of it with the director directly or through the cinematographer?
In the early days, we tended to work the English system where the director went to the operator.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course,
because they were those very different systems, the English system and the American system. Yeah,
very much so. And that was a bit of a shock when I did go to America that that change was so different. But in those early days in Australia, no, the director would very much talk to the operator. So I found that I did end up working with a lot of English directors who came out in those early days to do episodic TV like Luke's Kingdom, which was, I think, an English-financed deal. I think Peter Weir was the only Australian to work on it. All the rest were English.
Wow.
So they worked that system, and I found that I was a fool if I didn't read and study that script as well as I could every night, get the call sheet and read the script and try to visualise what we'd shot prior to that scene or what we'd shot after it if we had, so that I could be at least maybe a little bit intelligent about the flow from one scene to the next scene or whatever. So that I can.
So you're really thinking about the edit as well as the shoot.
Absolutely. And I love doing that.
Yeah.
Because to me, the whole end line was to make a better film. And to do that, then if you could help the editor get a nice transition between scenes or cuts, continuity between cuts, and I'm anal about continuity.
Yeah.
It was hammered into me by those early continuity girls. And it wasn't only situation continuity, it was geographical continuity.
Yeah,
it got down to where when the baddies left the bank to go to their hideout, if they left left to right, they have to arrive at their hideout left to right.
And there's a thing there because, yes, you can go, okay, well, that's being pedantic, but it's also about not snapping the audience out of the experience.
Well, yes, exactly. And I always I worked hard at that in the early days because I started to envisage the screen as a window.
Yep.
And we've got to get the audience through that window into our world.
Yeah.
And our world is 360 inside that window. To do that, a lot of it I felt was part and parcel of the continuity and flow of the entire film. So that geographical continuity flowing, that we could subconsciously say to the audience that over there in the darkness to the left of the window is the baddie's hideout.
Yeah.
And the police station's over on the right. And so that they subconsciously, if you cut to the police station saying, we know where the baddies are, let's go get them, and they drive out of the police station left to right, they're actually going the wrong way.
Yeah.
In a subconscious mind.
Yep.
Maybe I got too anal about all of this, but I did feel it was part of what I was hoping was a flow of images that would capture the audience and not let them...
Take them on a holistic kind of visual experience.
Yeah, and not let them go back to their seat.
Yeah.
And start again, trying to drag them into our world and encapsulate them there so that film or whatever it was total for them. They were there.
Yeah. I guess there's another practical element to that as well, where if you've got that consistency through the whole story of the geographic continuity of it, that also gives the editor a lot of options in terms of if you've got geographical continuity just between this scene and that scene, but then it reverses somewhere else, then they're tied to just those cuts without breaking that geographic continuity. Whereas if you've got that as an overarching structure that you're working within, then it kind of gives them a lot of flexibility to work with that flow in the edit.
Exactly. And later when I went over to America and found that these rules were... Going to America shattered me in a way, because in Australia we had the laboratory, our film laboratories...
Yeah.
Colour film, Atlab, whatever, would work a one light print.
Yeah.
I believe it was 25, 25, 25 across the board. And we had to shoot our negative to suit that.
Yeah.
Now, that gave us one hell of an advantage as photographers over the American, I found, when I got there, because they weren't doing that.
Yeah.
I arrived in America courtesy of being... taken there by Peter Weir to do Witness, or actually Mosquito Coast first.
Yeah. But two extraordinary films.
Well, and Mosquito Coast crashed and burned, and we were sent back to Australia. And then Peter rang quite a few weeks later, six, 8 weeks later, and said, I've got another film to do in America. It'll happen very quickly.
Wow.
Can you do it? And I had a couple of commercials, I think. I cancelled those and said, yep, I'm there. And it was Witness. So I got over there and I had a New York laboratory, Technicolor in New York, and of course I go to see them, as you always do, before a picture. And I said, so, our dailies, it'll be one light dailies? Yeah, one light dailies. I said, oh, great, so you'll be processing, 25, 25, 25 across the board?
Yeah.
And they went...
Close to that.
I said, but it is set, isn't it? You know, your lights are set so that my negative will portray what mistakes I've done. And they went, oh, no, we'll correct your mistakes. I said, hold up, hang on. So you have a one light print, but you'll correct them. They said, yeah, we have a one light print for every shot. So they grade the dailies. And that was all I found out later, that to get the producers and the studio to always go to that lab, because dailies look great.
Wow.
So they didn't worry about the cameraman.
So it was
all
about protecting their reputation.
Didn't worry about the cameraman. Bugger him, you know, that he's shooting rubbish. Then I found out, I pulled out a colour temperature meter. Doing a late afternoon rundown, and I've got the colour temperatures going on the lamps. And the gaffer and the camera guys were like, what is that? I said, well, colour temperature meter.
Yeah.
Thinking they'd know everything about it because it's America.
Yeah.
The home of the American Cinematographer Manual.
Yep.
Didn't have a clue what it was.
Really?
They said, a colour temperature meter. What is that? What are you? I said, well, I'm measuring the colour temperature of the light, you know, so that I can match to it, and as it gets redder and redder as the sun goes down, I can match the lamp, the fill lights.
Yeah.
I said, what do the big boys do here? And this lovely camera operator, he was a focus puller then. I actually bumped him up. A couple of films later, I bumped him up to camera operator. And I said, what do the big boys do? And they said, fix it in the lab. Wow. I said, but you can't fix the colour change.
Yeah.
Because the sun's going redder.
They're fighting each other.
And your lamps are still blue for midday or 3 o'clock.
I got caught with that on a commercial once really badly.
Did you? I think everybody gets caught. You know. So I was keeping track of all that once I became a lighting cameraman as well as an operator. It was a bit hard using an operator in America. We had to. The union said so. And there was no way I could operate on witness. And once again, the operator was a lovely guy, but it was more. He was more involved in his job looking good than making a good film. Do you know what I mean? There's a big, big difference.
Micro and the macro.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So all of that was a big shock going into America, and it was painful at times because I'd have to sit there watching dailies and the directors say, it's not looking real good. I'd say, no, it isn't. It's not a one light off the negative. It's actually their idea of it.
Yeah, their interpretation of it.
That. Then I found out later that cameramen would go to the lab in the morning and watch the dailies that the lab had corrected.
Really? And correct them.
And recorrect the dailies. And I'd say, but you're handling the negative.
Yeah.
Why are you handling the negative? Why don't you just own up and blow through the bad dailies and wait until you release print, you know? Don't handle your negative. No, it's all to look good.
Wow.
So it was a different
way. Looking good along the way rather than just...
Exactly. It was a very much different way of making movies.
I think there really is... there is a real advantage that Australian cinematographers had through that period, and I came in at the very, very end of that before digital started to hit, of the one-light work print. And you really did know exactly where you were at. You know, if you were a little bit over or a little bit under or you didn't balance it up, you knew exactly where you were at. And
That's why we used to wake up at 4 a.m. in a cold sweat. I should have opened up another half stop onto that. I should have got more light into there, you know. But then you go along and watch your one light dailies and think, oh, it's a little heavy, but it's okay, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But you could – I think what it did was it sped up that process of refining the accuracy of what you were doing because you could see the little changes. Okay, that was a little bit over. It was a little bit under. Whereas if you're seeing that corrected, there's just no way of refining that.
That is the whole key to it, is that because that was a one-light print in the lab, we could find out exactly how far over exposure or under exposure our negative would go.
Yeah.
And we could push it a little bit more every time you'd watch dailies and you'd think, that's still hanging in there. I could maybe go a little darker. And it's still there, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One of the great lessons I heard in America when I got was day for night. Always the bane, I think, of every cameraman, how to do day for night. And the standard routine of pulling your 85 and underexposing two stops was the norm back then. And then I heard this lovely story in America where because they printed and corrected every shot daily, he did his day for night, and it came back still looking pretty bright. So he said, "No, day for night. Make sure you say on the sheets it's day for night." And they did it, kept going, and it still looked very bright. Put day for night in big red letters on it. And it still looked overly bright until finally the lab report came back, which he used to ring in every morning.
Yeah,
get a lab. How's the negative? Negative's great. But the print's looking good, coming off now, looking good. But the report came back to him like, the negative's very thin. We can't save you this time. Because you know, he was underexposing further and further and further. He was 3 or 4 stops under.
Yeah.
And he lost the whole thing. And it's a classic story of who's chasing who.
Yeah, yeah.
And the poor old – they weren't reading the instructions on the sheets.
They were just looking at the pictures and – I've actually seen the equivalent thing happen with digital, where the cinematographer was working off a monitor, beautiful big calibrated monitor in studio, and they were doing night scenes, and they were going darker and darker, and weren't working off a light meter, so there's no objective point of reference.
Exactly.
And so they were just going darker. And as they made the set darker and darker, their eyes would adjust, they'd go back to the monitor and,
exactly.
Oh, that looks good. Yep. That's good. darker and darker. Yeah. And the colourist would brighten it up and bring it to a reasonable level. They just kept going and going and going till the same thing happened. They just fell off the edge and there's nothing there.
Yeah,
there's nowhere to go. And I think that's where, you know, whether it's a light meter or some sort of waveform or some sort of, you've got to have some sort of objective measure to reference back to kind of go, okay, well, we're not falling off the edge.
Yeah. We had big night scenes out in Namibia on Mad Max Fury Road, and I was terrified of them because they were big, wide scenes with panning and towers that were being shot to cover that whole area. And I, you know, with Sean Conway, the gaffer, we were starting to mull it over. And then all of a sudden the edict came through from George, we're going day for night. I thought, yeah, beauty. Oh, wait a minute, we're on digital. How does digital handle it?
Yeah.
And the lovely AJ, Andrew Jackson, now visual effects man, such a lovely guy. And he came up quietly one day with his laptop and he said, John, I want you to have a look at this. And flipped it open, pulled up an image, and it was good. I could tell it was day for night, but it was good.
Yeah.
And I said, that looks good. What's all that about? He said, well, that was shot at midday.
Wow.
And I said, well, I'm not unhappy with that. That looks great. Is that what you feel we can get for the film? He said, oh, I think so. But the only thing is, he said, I know your standard rules of film is pull the 85 and underexpose two stops. I'm going to ask you something that you might not be used to. He said, I want to ask you to open up two stops.
Wow. Said, talk about counterintuitive.
I said, AJ, let's get some seats in here and we better sit down and have a yarn about this because that's a little bit, you know, that's out, right out there, that. And when he explained it, in I feel basically a line. I know he'd be more technical about it, but it was simply that we had a very dark truck and the idea was to backlight it, obviously, or side light.
Yeah.
Very dark truck, very dark wardrobe. Charlize playing the warrior was in dark makeup on a forehead, half a face. Everything was very dark. He said, if you underexpose two stops and if we want to pull anything up out of that, it'll get noise. So he said, if we overexpose for that first up, we'll print it down. And then when we want to pull anything up out of that shadow
it's
area,
there.
It's all there. Wow. And it's clean.
Yeah.
I said, done. Got up and walked away and said, done. So we were in Namibia and this American cameraman, very, very high-standing American cameraman, rang up and he said, John, I hear you're doing day for night on digital. What are you doing? And I said, well, you get a bit of a shock, man. I said, we're not underexposing at all. We're overexposing two stops and working it in post. Oh, really? Click. and he literally hung up.
Wow.
He didn't want to know about that because, and I had to guess it at this stage, I felt deep down he was worried about what his day for night would look like in dailies.
Yeah.
And he had to have a dark image.
Yeah.
And my immediate reaction of overexposing two stops wasn't exactly in line with what he was thinking.
Yeah.
I'm not positive about that answer, but I think that's possibly why he just went, I'm out of here, rather than not. Didn't want to know.
Yeah.
But I think what they did, AJ particularly, but the post boys on Fury Road did with the day for night, and in the end, quite rightly, we shot front lit, side lit, back lit, you name it.
Yeah.
And it all melds together. It works. Yeah. They put stars up in the sky, put grads on it, you know, in post.
Yeah.
It made the shooting so simple and all the work then occurred in post, which is the future of digital filmmaking, I think.
And how involved were you in that post process in the grade?
Not much. I wasn't because it took a long time. It was a good 8 months to almost a year of editing and post. George is very particular.
Yep.
And that's what made it such a great film, I feel. There are a lot of edicts in there that George had learnt over the years and had read about or practiced on earlier films,
yep.
and put them together on Fury Road. And one of the big ones was centre framing all the way through. And also the day for night and pushing that to front lit, side lit, not being pedantic about how we shot it,
yep.
but doing it in post. He's a great advocate of the post power of post. And I feel rightly so because it's there. It's available and you can paint with it.
It's a tool you can play with.
But it's taken away an awful lot of the creative value of a cameraman. I mean, yeah. like stunt people now, you go to a movie with massive stunts and you say, oh, God, that looks dangerous. And then you find that, you know, all of the characters, the bodies in it have been painted in.
Yeah, yeah.
They weren't there at all. Whereas in those early days when we shot Man from Hong Kong and all those incredible action stunt films in the early days, including the Mad Maxes, obviously, where stunties did the job and you walked out of a film and said, gee, those guys are immortal, you know, they're amazing, because you knew they did them.
Yeah, and there's a real double-edged sword there as well, isn't there, that, you know, you can have these extraordinarily dangerous things happening on screen without necessarily putting somebody's life at risk. But there's also the fact that it's not grounded in its own reality to the same extent quite often. I think that it's interesting also in the context of Fury Road, where George Miller made the choice to have so much of it happening in camera to do that kind of grounding, but then also so much happening in post.
Exactly, and that the brilliance of Guy Norris's years, literally, of pre-production, of being able to fathom how he could make those stunts occur out there in the desert. When I tell people, talking with Dean Semler in America over lunch, that's another thing the Americans find funny about Australians.
Yeah.
How many times people have said to me, do you have dinner and lunch with other Australian cameramen? I say, oh, God, yeah. How do you think I keep up with all the latest trends? and they say, gosh, no, Americans don't socialise as cameramen together.
Really? Wow.
No, there's a sort of a like
there's a real tradition of that here. It's but just
every
part
time
of the...
I go to America, it's like, Dean, what are you doing?
Yeah,
you know, and all the other guys too. They all get together and we'll go down to Father's office, you know, at Century City there, and just eat giant hamburgers. And, and there's no jealousies or animosities or anything. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was talking to Dean about how he went to America in the earlier days, and some producers said to him, God damn it, man, that Mad Max, you know, you must have killed thousands of people. And he said, look, 70% or 80% of the movie, the truck's not moving. And he went, I don't believe that. Of course it's moving. He said, no, it's not. It's being rocked and the camera's doing the movement.
Yeah.
And you're reversing the visual imagery. Instead of moving the truck and keeping the camera steady, you lock the truck off and move the camera.
Yeah.
Wow. And it created the illusion. And that's what movies are made of. Well, the power of illusion.
Yeah, that's where the magic is.
And then we did it on Mad Max.
Yeah.
The truck was, if we didn't, even when we saw the ground now, looking down at wheels, I immediately would say, well, we'll have to do this on the move. And HA would quietly say, no, we'll make the ground move.
Make the ground move later.
Yeah, but the wheel's off the ground. It won't go round. And then boys would say, no, we'll make the wheel turn. We've got electric motors on them. We make them turn and the ground's moved by post. Everything's great. But the actor is as safe as houses.
Yeah.
Because nothing's moving.
It was a perfect compromise.
It was. And it was the perfect way to make that movie.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of the stunts and George's, I think, and Margie's amazing editing.
Oh, incredible.
That kept that pace up so fast that I loved it, because I'd always thought in the past our visual appreciation of what's happening on the screen is so fast.
Yeah.
Why delay?
So intuitive.
Yeah, and I used that in early days of operating, that when the director said, well, we'll pan with the car and watch it drive away. But it wasn't the end of the film. And I kept thinking, but the editor will want to cut that. So I set the camera up to pan it at a minimal arc.
Yeah.
So I could lock it off as quickly as I could and watch it drive away. Then the editor could cut in
whenever they
to a static frame, which back then we always tried to do. Nowadays they don't care. But back then, so I'd always bring the camera right up and make the pan quick and sharp, get the car driving away, cut to the next scene or whatever.
So your camera position would factor into that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'd work it.
Instead of being well back and watching it and have to pan it all the way around that arc.
Get on a wider lens.
Right up and do a short pan to get it down the road.
Wow.
Unless it was the last shot of the film, you know, and of course then you
want to let it play out.
Yeah, so your name could go up on it. You have to have somewhere to put your name. You know? So things like that in those. And it was wonderful. I did Lorenzo's Oil for George.
You know, yes.
And thoroughly enjoyed working with George on that. I jumped on to Fury Road at short notice because Dean was going to do it. Always did Mad Max's.
Yeah.
But he had family problems that he wanted to try and solve. And being away for 8 months in Namibia wasn't going to do it.
Yeah.
And he amicably bailed out of the film. And I think George couldn't find anybody else, so he rang me. And I jumped at it. I was on the verge of retiring. And I hadn't enjoyed doing the last film that I thought I'd do. It wasn't as enjoyable as I'd wanted it to be. And I knew Mad Max would be iconic.
Yeah.
And so I jumped on it and grabbed it and loved doing it. But a lot of what I loved was George's ideas. 30 years before, on one of those episodic TV things that I think was in black and white long ago, and we had the old 4x3 format of TV.
Yep.
And the director said, he said, John, I want to cut this scene, argument scene, very quickly. He said, do you think we could put the crosshairs, put them in the middle of the frame? Not that you've got much room on a 4x3. But could you put them in the middle? And then when I cut, your eye doesn't change too much.
Right.
And I said, oh, yeah, great. So threw all compositions out the window and just stuck them in the centre for one scene.
Wow.
And then it went away until Fury Road. And I jumped onto Fury Road and George said, I want the crosshairs on the point of the subject matter of every shot.
Wow.
So that in the fast cutting of an anamorphic frame, your eyes don't have to travel backwards and forwards across the screen. So that was the edict. And I thought, man, you know, that's balls because, you know, we did it for an 8-shot argument scene 35 years before.
Yeah.
George does it for a 2-hour bloody movie.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic.
And I heard that was happening. I just thought, that can't possibly work. But then sitting there in the cinema watching it, and it does.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And we fought it, the operators, the three of us, all kind of...
Every instinct would be...
Yeah, it was horrible, actually, because so much information was happening on the edges that you'd love to frame up with the actor.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, the red dot goes on her nose was the eating. When George laughs about this now, I hope he still is. But he brought it up at a meeting the other day and he said, was I that forthright about it? And I said, oh, you were, George. We were on Radio George, you know, we were listening to you the whole time. And it was like, AJ, put the red dot on their nose. And I love it now that it has done it because an awful lot of films are copying that in that they want to edit quickly and that's the way to do it.
It was something genuinely new to do a whole film
exactly
in that style. Yeah.
Other films had been done that way. I think that's where George got his feeling that this would work for the entire film. There were only a couple.
Yeah.
But I think since Fury Road, particularly for action
suddenly fashionable.
Movies, very, very,
The post-supervisor on that film, Matt Town, is a very good friend of mine. We had a few conversations at the time about all the work that was done with the eyes.
I've always, over the years since I started lighting, have tried to make a very good value of eyes because they're going to tell you everything.
Yeah.
And you battle with trying to, in those earlier days before post abilities, to lighten the eyes, to brighten them up.
Yep.
You had to put in eye lights, and that was always on top of the camera with a little. And sometimes you saw them and you hated yourself later. Other times they weren't enough and you still didn't get the eyes. A lot easier now. But the eyes were so powerful. And I found little ways, I felt, of finding the spark in the eyes. And when these brilliant little LED lights came out, little bricks, I found that there's the eyeball is curved at the front but has flats as it goes back.
Yeah.
It flattens out.
Right.
And if you can find the reflective angle of that flat, you can put a little light at 90 degrees nearly.
Really?
And it'll hit that flat area and spark like crazy.
Wow.
So I used to do that. I used to put little lights in there to get that spark.
Definitely going to try that. Yeah, I've never come across that.
It's dangerous because, very dangerous. I did a picture with the lovely, I loved her. Angelina Jolie, and I put those in a lot, sometimes two of them, one each side, to make sure we got a kick in the eyes. And they became a norm. And quite often, Angelina would hit the set and we mightn't have had them there because we really didn't need them at that moment.
Yeah.
But they had to be there. There was a little like look around at a sort of like,
Where are my lights gone?
John, where are the eyelights? And I'd say, on their way. We're just getting them out. Sorry, getting them out of the truck. We should have called you after they were in. She'd give you that look, you know. Like
that dynamic between the actors, the stars in particular, and the cinematographer, it's quite an important one, isn't it?
Incredibly important. Sometimes dangerous, again, because in the earlier days without monitors, even now with monitors, which are generally in another room.
Yeah.
So the actor's not relating to directly to the director. That I found in film negative work without monitors and also in the digital work, that an actor can very quickly use you as the camera operator as the criteria of the performance.
Yeah.
Dangerous. Yeah. So dangerous it's not funny. And I found in the early days better to throw your head on the ground. So all they see is the top of your head.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd do that.
Yeah.
You'd hear from the other room when the monitors came in, they'd say, how was it? How was it for camera? Because technically in the earlier days, it was always the operator had the problems, the bigger problems. Sound might have had an aeroplane or a truck or something. But the camera operator had bumps or late starts or...
Yep.
And so it was all, the director always sort of said to the operator, how was it for you? So you had to have it is a funny story, but I used to balance what I'd say on the way they said cut.
Ah.
And the lovely Ken Hannum from 100 years ago on episodic TV, we had a Q&A with the two of us up there and somebody asked the question about exactly that. What is that relationship of the actor to the camera operator, the director?
Yeah.
So I went into this and said, well, I always used to say, I'd hear, how was it for you, John, as camera operator? And I would think, the way they said cut, very excited, they got it. I had a bump in the middle. Nobody will notice that. And I thought, we were a little late on the dolly stuff. No, good, fantastic, you know, to think, oh, great, say the director and walk off.
Because if the first thing you in your reaction is some seed of doubt that's sowed in there, then everyone's going to pick up on that.
Well, I did once have an operator who was a bit far too precious about the whole thing. And it was cut, how was it for you? Oh, I can do better. I could go again. And we get up to four or five takes. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know, this guy's... And finally this actor bottled. And we know that actors can bottle. We hear, you know, big American stars recently are bottling against people who whisper on the set or cameramen who are adjusting lights during takes. and distracting them.
Yeah.
And it's rightly so that they blow the Christ out of them. I believe in it.
Yeah.
Because this actor blew the Christ out of us and the operator. He said, who the hell is this guy who was telling me to act my socks off five times because he possibly could do it better?
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, yes. Ooh. And I raced over, I grabbed him, and I've only taken operators outside about three times in my entire life. Grabbed him and said, outside. And I put him on the wall and I said, don't ever want to hear it again. Don't ever want to hear it again.
Yeah,
you use the rehearsals for that.
Yep.
The director will give you rehearsals. Don't use takes with actors in it ever again. Ever again. If I'm anywhere near you, or better still, if anybody's anywhere near you, become an operator that gets it right every time, because that actor's acting his socks off, her socks off.
Yeah, yeah.
There's actresses that try to cry and performances are going to suffer because I could do better. Get out, get in there and take one is print from now on. And I really blew the – because I realised – you can't do that to actors. So my whole life's now, from then basically, is making the actor's room on the set theirs.
Yeah.
I get the rehearsals for lighting, trims, bang. Are you ready? Yes, I am. Hand it over to the actors and the director.
Yeah, wow.
You don't fiddle and fuss.
Because it's always tempting to.
Oh, sometimes you have to,
but
in that case, I'd make it a big deal. I'd go to the first, say, I need a trim. After that take, it is not quite hitting the right marks here. It doesn't matter about that.
But so you stop and do that.
Yeah, and at least then it's a positive change.
Yeah.
It's not a fiddle fuss and distracting for actors or stuff like that.
That was part one of this special two-part interview with John Seal. Stay tuned for part two in the next episode. Thanks for stopping in.